Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gabaza, and for today, we're going to be getting into a conversation about the state of education in South Africa, and I guess the economic impact thereof, because we often talk about how education is a big enabler to get a lot more people into the jobs market, a lot more people, to start their own businesses, a lot more people to invent things, a lot more people to innovate, a lot more people to contribute. But what if, you have things not going the way that they're meant to go, even at the most basic level, which spills over into high school level, which spills over into, possibly the tertiary, and then spills over into the jobs market? What do we talk about there? So for today, we are joined by someone who's been trying to tackle this very problem, and that is Dr. Corinne Varady, and he is the CEO of Idea Group, and we're just going to get an understanding of how technology can be used to help us to democratize the quality of education in South Africa. Dr. Varady, greetings to you today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start with Idea Group before we launch into the big topic around education and everything that's wrong. As Idea Group, what is it that you guys are up to? What is it that you guys are doing? I think my understanding is that you guys are working to improve things such as access to education using technology platforms, but I'm sure you could explain what I've just said way better and in greater detail than I can.
Thank you. Thanks, Mudiwa. Yeah, I mean, we were born out of actually a project that I'd been working on for 10 years prior up in East Africa, where we'd been building a lot of low-income private schools. And we realized that the model was just not scalable enough to be able to reach the sorts of population growth figures that we were seeing all across sub-Saharan Africa. So we then looked at how do we bring in the global best of curriculum experts and then create these fantastic, excellent teams in every country so that we can localize our digital curriculum and deliver that through technology. So when we always talk about platforms or learner management systems, we think of a tool. And that tool has a critical success because it has content or resources that have been created by teachers, local and global educators. What we did was we flipped that model and we said we want to focus on the content, the curriculum, and then develop the technology behind that that makes it as flexible, as light, as friendly as possible for students, but focusing on educational content first. So essentially what IDEA does is it delivers content mastery and a personalized education solution in a really multimedia way, meaning really interactive, very colorful, very bright, very engaging for students, but does so within the national syllabus requirements towards achieving content mastery and assessment outcomes, so real goals of excellence. And we do that using technology. That means we're more than just a tool, but we really try to purpose ourselves as being user and student-centered with technology as the vehicle that we deliver that through.
All right. So with everything that, you guys are trying to achieve, then let's maybe get into some of the big things within the context of a country like within the context of a country like South Africa, for you to be operating in a country like this, because I do understand that you guys have a presence in a number of different geographies. It obviously means that you guys have you've identified some issues in the local context. I think a lot of issues around education in South Africa, basic education, exams, matric, all of this stuff are quite well documented, well argued, and have been, a sore point for many people for a number of years. And I would even stretch and say possibly into the decades. For you specifically as Idea Group, what is it in the spectrum of these much debated issues are you guys looking to specifically attack or deal with here in South Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. There's such a broad spectrum. Education and training covers right from early childhood development right to higher education. So to pretend that we could take on that entire sector is naive. What we have looked at is particularly in the basic education space, particularly in lower income communities, where there needs to be support both of government schools. So where we can see an overlap of both private and public sector, how can we actually tackle that band of quintile one to threes that are really struggling to be able to look at matriculation as being something that actually allows them to go on to, say, a vocation or onto higher education studies. So how do we affect government school enrolled students to such a significance that we can actually see some moving of the needle? I'm not pretending that we've taken on that problem and succeeded in it in ourselves, but certainly in areas that we have been involved in, we've been able to contribute in those outcomes. And so that's really our mission. How do we make sure we democratize the quality of our outcomes being through the implementation of technology in a lower income bracket in South Africa?
Are we talking basic education, high school, tertiary? Like, at what level have you guys pitched yourself?
We're really looking at basic education. I mean, we've branched right. You know, I mean, in saying that, there's a sort of runway or a pathway. It's very hard for us to just put our hands up and say, you know, this is not our space, because actually they bleed into one another. So what's happening in early childhood and preschool education and early primary affects what's happening in secondary high school and certainly onto matriculation, as well as it does through to vocation and tertiary. So we do work in those other spaces, but our biggest focus is how do we deliver the foundations of basic education, so being R-12, how do we deliver that more effectively so that students are more prepared for both the job market and or for higher education of whatever that looks like, so that they have a greater opportunity to see an open playing field and an even playing field when they take on something further in their lives.
You know, I like the fact that you speak about, basic education and also preschool, because when it comes to preschool, it sort of feels like, the word preschool means something completely different nowadays compared to when, you know, at least I was growing up, because when I was growing up, you know, you could possibly start some of these, what's considered preschool at the age of maybe four. With the learning group, then you get into a formal preschool at the age of five, and then perhaps you are in grade one at the age of six, you know, just depending. But now I see that a lot of parents are even taking their kids to these daycare groups at the age of two, and kids are learning how to, you know, read, write, sound out letters, all of this stuff. And it's just not making sense to me that, you know, in such an environment, we're saying that, kids at basic education are disadvantaged. Where's the disconnect?
I think there's a challenge because we have a rapidly growing population. We have an under-resourced population of educators. So whilst we do see pockets of excellence in a whole range of different approaches to programs, particularly in that early childhood development space, we know that we can see numeracy and literacy increases that occur at times in certain ways because there may be a perfect storm that comes along of both resource, professional development, the community upliftment. But the challenge is that often doesn't occur in a regular and consistent manner. And I think that there is a significant role that needs to be played in understanding what are all of these adverse pieces that are tugging against one another, because, you know, the literacy of a community and parents has a role on a child. the role of professional development in an educator and being willing for us to say that we want to support our educators further to be able to extend the learning of that child during those years is critical. The resources that we place around that child is are critical. So I think that it's very hard for us because we think that we're ticking boxes by maybe putting someone into an intervention program or putting a child into a daycare center or putting them on a device. None of those things alone create the whole child. Education is a much more holistic approach to how we develop children. And so when we look at developed education sectors, they don't approach it from a one program or one band-aid solution. We have to also learn from that the best of our students globally have come from environments where we've been able to tick multiple boxes. And I think the challenge is about how do you do that at a scalable level? How do you do that when resources are constrained? And how do you do that when public sector's under constant pressure to deliver something across the board? And not necessarily can they always be looking at the outcomes of that something, because actually our current system is set up to be so socialized that we have to accept that something is better than nothing. And that's the challenge when you try to then move a needle from what does it mean for a child in a preschool to enter school, or certainly to go through kind of grade 3 to grade 4 systemic examinations and to see improvements. Well, the big question to me is, well, what were we delivering those children? And where was that democracy when it came to education? Was the same thing given to those children? And the answer obviously is no. And I think that then what we try and do is compensate by investing in certain parts and pushing funds and resources or trying to have high visibility projects in certain at-risk communities. The challenge with that, obviously, is that we're still not developing the whole child. We're still not necessarily developing the parents in the community to understand why it's so important. And we're often leaving the teachers behind. And so therefore, the child doesn't necessarily grow in that space either. I think it's ultimately that if we put the child at the center of this conversation, when we talk about education, we can then start to look at, well, what do outcomes look like for that child, and not what do outcomes look like for a program? And that's a very different conversation than I think we're having at the moment.
One of the things I'm very keen to understand then, Corin, is when we look at this disconnect that we're talking about right now, it feels like this is yet another manifestation of the duality of the South African economy that we always hear about, that you've got the most economically developed economy on the continent. You've got some of the best infrastructure on the African continent when it comes to education, when it comes to doing business, when it comes to, I guess, just general infrastructure, roads, schools, clinics, hospitals, all of that type of thing. But existing in that environment is people that have access. Existing in that environment is people that don't have access. And I think you've articulated that point quite a bit from earlier on. But one of the things I'm then keen to understand, and I think it helps us on a platform like this that is maybe finance and economics based, is at the end of the pipeline, right? You sort of alluded to it earlier on, about the impact on your tertiary levels and then into the jobs market, and how you perhaps don't have, people that are best placed, to get into the jobs market. But apart from that, is there any research or data that maybe gives us a sense on a broader economic level of what this disconnect is actually doing, whether it's output, GDP, whatever it is, that you could perhaps share with us to paint a picture of what all of this stuff is doing at the end of the pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's been a lot of research. We can actually tie the research between, Professor Nick Spall's work in terms of the real pass rate around matriculation, and then that includes our retention rates of higher education matriculants. And what does that real pass rate look like? I mean, it's a contentious issue within the education sector, but we can look at that and our unemployment figures, and particularly around youth unemployment, and what our throughput rate is. Because part of the challenge that we have to start to work out is that our basic education, our higher education, and our Department of Labor are all connected. What I don't think is being done accurately at the moment is bridging those gaps. So I think Department of Higher Education and certainly those that look after the TVET courses are looking and talking to industry and looking at SME development and skills for entrepreneurship and what do we need in terms of an employment workforce. What I don't think is happening is fundamentally that the Department of Higher Education and the Department of Basic Education have a bridge. There's a whole range of reasons that's both been politicized and also that economically have been ignored for some time. Partly because I think industry also struggles to understand what its role is with, say, a grade four learner or a grade seven learner or a grade 10 learner, or even fundamentally with a grade 12 learner that's about to go through matriculation. The big question for them is, well, what is my role if I'm actually looking at workforce, or I'm looking at candidates to take into internship programs or learnership programs, why am I worrying backwards downstream so far that I have to be looking 10 to 15 years? Well, it's very clear to us that that is impacting, and as we're seeing with our youth unemployment rates, I mean, I think we could say across the board, our quarterly labor surveys are showing us that, even unemployment figures are going up. But particularly if I start looking at the youth unemployment figures and anybody sitting under the age of 34 and the increases that we're seeing, and yet we're seeing these statistical increases in pass rates in matriculation. So one would think that therefore that would indicate that we should be seeing more qualified individuals going into the workforce, and so therefore our youth unemployment figures going down. We're not seeing that. Now, is it because there's a critical lack of jobs? I would argue no. I would say that we're actually not meeting the job specificity or requirement that a lot of these organizations need, because a technical pass rate at the moment is not necessarily meeting the functional pass or even achievement rate that industry is asking for. And so I think a huge gap that we're missing at the moment in the model is that we need to be investing downstream so that we do see in the next 5 to 10 years a cohort and generation that not just the very top 10% are being taken into industry easily. And I say easily because we do know that there's, another 20 to 30% of the workforce that do gain and work through vocational programs and upgrade themselves to be able to take on employment then more naturally as well. But we're talking about that a lot of our workforce goes overseas at our top matriculant achievement rates. And then we then have to then try and slowly work through the higher education space to enable students to be able to bridge and to take second chance programs, to get themselves into programs in tertiary, to then take on the labour market. It's a major challenge and blockage if we're not actually looking at, well, how could we do this better the first time around? And that's fairer on students. So, I mean, that's the democracy of education. But actually, it's very clear in terms of where our economic blockers are occurring from an employment point of view. We're just simply not creating enough qualified individuals in the employment workforce, as opposed to just pushing numbers through, because we have so many in a population, particularly in government, that we now need to start seeing them matriculate. And therefore, we statistically need to move that needle to make it look better every year that we're actually matriculating more and more students. Now, that's not happening anywhere else on the continent. In fact, it's not happening anywhere else in the world, where we're actually moving the needle of our benchmarks down so that we can move the number of pass rates up. What it is having an impact on is both our higher education throughput rates, our real pass rate, but also what that real pass rate means to industry. Are these individuals functionally, scientifically, technically literate to be able to take on the jobs and roles that they're required to in a digital economy? Big question mark there.
Yeah, it's a huge question mark, and like you said, very contentious issue. But I like how you've been able to sort of draw that line between the those various aspects, from basic into higher education, and then how you can sort of get a line through to your tertiary education, and how that's also impacting life when it comes to the jobs market. And interestingly, I attended a recent conference that was talking about South Africa's ability to take advantage of the digital economy. And one of the big talking points that came out of that whole, 3 or 4 hour engagement was the fact that for South Africa to take advantage of a digital economy, you need people that are digitally literate, that are literate, and that can actually go into some of these positions. And someone said something very interesting, which was then echoed a couple of times. And I am just venturing, to check if this statement resonates with what you've just said, doctor, which is that they say that it's not that South Africa has an unemployment issue, it's that South Africa has an employability issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely how I would summarize my feeling about it. And I think, certainly from someone in the sector, we come from it with a very impassioned way, which is to say, well, what does that mean? What does employability mean? It fundamentally means that we don't have an inclusive education system, right? Because if you were to look at employability, well, we do have employability in the privileged, in the higher income areas where students are going to maybe private schools or Model C schools or even top government schools, and who are going on and passing. Or actually achieving in their matric, I mean, pass is not even a consideration for a lot of those students, and who are going on to either top South African, African, or global universities. That question mark around employability is not there for them. But for the majority of the population, employability is a major, major concern. And the question mark that a lot of students have when they come out of school is, what was the last 12 years for if it wasn't to actually better prepare me to take on self-determination through employability? So I think that if we're, I don't think that we should ever make a choice between creating jobs in this country, and certainly attracting, even foreign direct investment to create jobs. I don't think that any of those things are incorrect. They have worked for other countries. The challenge I think we do have is that, can we fill those positions in a country that maybe the concept of qualification and benchmark means a very different thing to us than what it does to, say, another country where benchmarks are beyond 50%, and even sometimes are at 70% when we start talking about achievement rates. We're not talking about pass rates. And I think a culture of pass versus a culture of excellence does differentiate both our basic and higher education space, which is ultimately impacting our labour market and our economy.
One of the things I'm then keen to understand, when you have such a situation that you're describing, then is for yourselves as a, I guess, technology-backed, type of platform, when it comes to education, how much of the factors that you've just described around education in general maybe feed into people's consumption of a platform, like yours? And I'm asking that because through the COVID-19 pandemic, we sort of saw, the issue of one's ability to continue to learn, through the online channels and that type of thing. We sort of saw that playing out where, the haves continue to be able to to learn and continue their education, but the have-nots or those that don't have access to computers, tablet, data, all of this different infrastructure, had their learning sort of stopping for a significant amount of time in 2020 and perhaps even parts of 2021. So in 2024 then, when it comes to education and the role that you're trying to play, you know, how have you found those aspects feeding into perhaps adoption of your own platform and I guess the type of people that have access to your platform?
Yeah, I mean, I think COVID was a double-edged sword for the digital education sector, and it was a tragedy for the education sector. We saw learning losses that people equated to 3 to 5 years. I think the knock-on effect is that we're going to be seeing them for 10 to 15 years because of the foundational skills loss. We've had to curriculum trim to try to get students back on track to certain programs. I mean, there are literally programs in provinces across South Africa called Back on Track. The Western Cape is leading one, but they're a challenge. They're a challenge because that, you know, formative period of a student's education was lost, and it's not as easy as just simply cramming it back in. It's sort of not how our brains and our cognitive maturity works. So certainly from a sector point of view, it was transformative overnight in that there was this extraordinary appetite for technology to come in and fill a gap. And I think the one thing that we needed to learn was that that is not the silver bullet solution. There was frustrations with what was being put out there, being used in technology. I think there were a lot of solutions created overnight that were like the Wild West. I mean, there were cowboys making money off parents who were vulnerable and who, were looking for something that was going to help to bridge their child, and it didn't do that. And I think that as a industry and as a sector, we had to learn and we had to iterate and we had to slowly work through the increased demand, because people thought, well, this is a hockey stick growth of revenue for us. This is going to be fantastic. People were investing in edtech solutions left, right and center. However, then there was a counter spring to that, which was that people wanted to go back to schools and parents needed to go back to work. And so therefore, schools became important. And we had to question the role of the school, because I actually think we started to realize that a lot of these schools were glorified babysitting clubs, but with curriculum, right? And I mean that in a nice way. And this is not taking a dig at schools, but you know, there was a fundamental logistical issue, which was parents couldn't stay home and look after their children all day long as they had to while they were also themselves locked down. And so when they needed to go back to work, they needed to find an opportunity for their children to. And so then what was the role in technology in all of that? Because now it was no longer what we were going to have to rely on. So therefore, what was it? So again, the question of the have and the have-nots kept coming up. The other question that popped up during COVID, which I think we didn't respond to very well, and UNICEF did a great conference on this in Paris about 2 years ago, which was the tragedy of COVID, which was the missed opportunity that we had to redefine what technology looked like in education, which I think we failed to do at a macro level globally, because we believed that conference call, that synchronous conference-based calling to students from teachers, so replicating the traditional model and then putting it into some form of tool, all of a sudden was digital learning, and we were increasing the access to quality education, which we didn't do. All we did was we kept students exceedingly bored with higher stress rates than they had previously, obviously contributed to by the fact that they were sitting in a pandemic and locked in their rooms as well. But we didn't see increases in this beautiful utopian model of quality education. So I think in responding to that, we have to start to think about, well, actually, was technology in education always supposed to be purposed for the haves? Or actually, should have we always been throwing this model on its head? Because if we believed that it was just those who came from higher income communities who should be accessing technology, what are we actually doing Are we providing them with a greater access to education? Well, my argument would be, particularly when they're going to high fee schools with the high fee paid teachers who are able to be retained because they're not being poached and taken overseas, where they have access to the resources, where they have literate and higher income earning parents. You know, we're talking again about that whole child, circling back to what we were discussing at the beginning, that environment is in place. But in an environment where maybe content, teaching, the numbers of students per class are so high in ratio of teacher to student that it is very difficult for the teacher to be able to deliver the curriculum, where the quality and feedback is either zero or very little. So therefore, their inability to improve themselves becomes, you know, simply null and void. Is that not where we should be focusing? Because we think of technology as something that's really expensive, but actually we know that technology and the deployment of enabled public sector technology and internet is actually quite inexpensive compared to building more schools. We should be looking at what are the equalizers, what are the areas that we can affect students. But we know that we can't deliver this always through high bandwidth solutions that we assume a 1 gigabyte line, you know, that is going into a student and that they need to have conference calls and that they can just work from home and that they can do these virtual or homeschool solutions. Okay, fine. But we need to be redefining what technology looks like in a post-pandemic world, because we can actually use technology and what we've learned out of the pandemic, we can use it to be able to hold those students, support them, give remediation and feedback, and maybe to help to get some of those learning losses out of the way so that students have a better chance down the line. We haven't actually tackled that properly enough. And I think that's partly because we don't believe as a sector, both financially, that there's a model, or that actually the model exists for lower income students, that e-learning, that digital learning, virtual schooling, all of the, you know, words and iterations that we can use off that belong in the lower income community space. And I think that that's a major, major challenge to our sector. And that's particularly apparent in South Africa, because that's where we see the least amount of partnership occurring, which is between private and public, in essentially government serviced communities. And I think that if we changed that model, we wouldn't believe that actually technology is all about having an Apple computer with a 1 gigabyte line gives you access to Zoom or Teams or any of those types of things, all where we're starting to talk about cost and infrastructure as being the blockers for why someone can't be using any device that they have on a low data bandwidth connection to be able to access quality resources and therefore improve their education. Are we really thinking about that? And I think coming out of this pandemic, we're still talking about 3 to 4 years later, are we thinking about that? And I can't understand in my mind why we're not grappling with both the financial and funding model of that, and also taking on that actually that's where innovation needs to occur to shift our entire economy.
And I think that's a great place for us, you know, to come to an end and land this discussion, Dr. Varady, which is around yourselves as Idea Group. Maybe you could give us a sense of, you know, what your platforms look like now. We are a business platform, so it's always great understanding business performance. What's your throughput like, user base? How many people have you been able to get, you know, onto your platform or through, you know, your various learning courses? I think earlier on you did mention the fact that yours is a huge focus on content and, you know, interactivity and that type of thing. But how is the business side of things for you guys? And from a business model point of view, you know, what's the model that you guys have, you know, put in place so that you guys are a, you know, sustainable entity?
Yeah, it's taken time to work some of that model out. And I think partly that was because there was a push and pull around whether the B2C or business to consumer subscription monthly license made sense in our space. That was what was occurring as a license-based model in many developed economies or developed education spaces. And even that was a challenge. There's been some giants who recently collapsed. So we'd invested a long time ago in what we call the B2B, B2G. So we really were focusing on how do we deliver our product to either groups of schools or networks or institutions who are going to have funded programs. So our end user is always the student, but our paymaster would maybe be somebody else within that supply chain. And then also around government, how can we support that, whether that's through government-based procurement or it's through funding of government-endorsed programs. So again, still student being our end user. And that was a unique model that we adopted many years ago because we could see that that was, where we were going to affect the most number of users. It was a challenge in the early years. I'm not going to deny that. But the customer acquisition cost is very different. There's a delay, it's a lag, there's a timeline that you have to invest in to get those large populations. But once you do, and once you can really see the change and you can see impact and you train your advocates and champions within that program to take on and to own the program, you find that the retention is much higher and that your customer acquisition cost is much, much lower. You're not having to have cold callers and individuals just trying to call every individual parent to see whether they're going to continue on a monthly basis. So that helped us post-COVID to see the business become profitable, and then, certainly to see that we were able to increase the numbers of users. I mean, across networks, because we also do white labeled versions of our own product. So that means that someone else can deliver it as an organization using our technology, using our content, all encrypted. We don't hand it over to individuals, but we manage it for them so that schools, institutions, departments of education, aid organizations can deliver a program that feels like their own, that where they own it, and they certainly feel comfortable with it. And that's, going to well over 1.5 million individuals at the moment and growing. So we feel very confident in this space that we've invested in the right type of business model, not at the exclusion of the other business models, but I can imagine that they're really a challenge, and they have very high touch points and a lot of certainly a lot of marketing and collateral that is required at a resource level. What we do is we focus our human resources on innovation and improvement of our product. So we accept that every version and every iteration, every time we put and publish a version of our multimedia content out there, particularly for multiple markets and multiple languages, we have to be changing that. And so our team focuses on that rather than having to focus on a major sales team and business development team to try and just reel in parents. That is a fairly unique model, but it has been a distinct difference that we and question mark that we have asked ourselves over the years. We've continued to invest in fewer clients, but that have larger and higher impact, and where there is a model of monitoring and evaluation going on alongside it, so that we can start to see what do the patterns of improvement look like, so that we know that we're innovating towards that improvement. And that means that, both we have an incentive to improve our product and our service delivery, but also that that there is a concept of what does the future look like for our clients.
Perhaps as a quick follow-up, what proportion of your business, whether it's the 1.5 million individuals you spoke about earlier on, or the schools, or whatever metric we're using, is South Africa specific versus your other geographies?
Yeah, I mean, South Africa makes up the largest portion of our business. So it's about 70% of our work. We've got a very large customer base and pipeline that we're taking South Africa beyond. But essentially, South Africa has been where we realized that being a South African business doing work for South African students was critical. We've now learned how to splice that off and create teams in every country to take that in the same localized, customized manner. We don't believe that a centralized unit can actually deliver a localized education product. It's so critical that we see that concept of customization and localization and contextualization for students, that we do that in every country. But essentially, our flagship is South Africa.
All right. So that's how we come to the end of today's conversation, just around, education in South Africa, and more specifically, how online education is seeking to tackle, some of the fundamental and systemic issues that are affecting learning in the country. Some of the things that Dr. Verity was able to articulate is some of the issues around access to education, on a basic, higher and tertiary level. And then also at the same time, this duality in the economy and how that manifests itself, in the education realms as well, because you might have, very, very tough learning outcomes, on one end, where people are struggling to pass things like matric, where your pass rates are being lowered, so that you can increase the number of people that are getting out at the end of that pipeline. But at the same time, this is all happening within the context of a country that has some of the best, globally recognized universities, and schools, in the world. So it just shows that there is a disconnect, on that, from that point of view. And then he was also just giving us some insight into, perhaps where some of the failings or some of the holes and challenges are, on the government side, on the policy side, but also, letting us know that this is one of those issues that needs to be tackled from multiple angles and with people, working together. I like the fact that as much as we talk about, the government's role in this, he was also then pointing out the fact that on the side of the private sector, for example, there are still a lot of questions and people trying to figure out what is the role of private sector companies and businesses in influencing learning outcomes for a child who is in, who is in grade 4, who is in grade 10, who is in grade 12, because you do in many instances need to be thinking about the pipeline of people that are going to be joining your learnerships, your graduate programs, your permanent positions, your mid-level management, your senior management executive, C-suite, and all of that stuff. There's a pipeline that does need to be thought about holistically, that people do need to think about. And he was also giving us some insight from an educator point of view, just around how the efforts to try and tackle some of these challenges, how certain things have worked, how people are still trying to figure how a lot of people have still tried to figure out how to do things when it comes to the online environment. The fact that certain models have actually seen the collapse of some of the large players. I think we have actually covered it when we think about the biggest company or the largest group on the JSE, that is Naspers and Prosus. They actually publicly came out with their last set of earnings around how some of their education investments have fallen short of expectation because the models just weren't right. We've seen disruption from things like your AI, and also at the same time, the excitement around COVID and online learning hasn't necessarily transferred into the world that we're sitting in 2024. Ending off just talking about the progress that Idea Group has been able to get, over time. Doctor, just giving us some sense to say that South Africa still makes up, the largest proportion of their business, about 70%, and how they're using the learnings that they have here to go out and also just to tweak and perfect their offering in other countries so that it's done on a localized level. So that's been it for today's discussion. It has been a great one, just around the state of education and some of the efforts that are being made to try and get that on the way. We were in conversation with Dr. Corinne Varady. He is the CEO of Idea Group. Dr. Varady, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Madiwa.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter. We're hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.